Hello and welcome to another edition of Mets Musings. I'm gonna cut this short because I had a little dental work done this week and I'm a little sore, so not gonna talk too much. And I do have a big down on the farm report. So Mets are playing a little bit better lately. They've been more competitive in these games. I know it's reaching for something that people don't want to hear about, but it is what it is. This team is more competitive, and like we said last episode, mainly these guys are fighting for spots. And the young guys are trying to stick with the team. And look, they've been performing pretty well. Ronnie Mauricio has continued his hot hitting since he's come up that he showed in AAA, and he's doing pretty well, playing a good second base and hitting. This could bode well for next year. Blaine Beatty has been struggling a little bit, but making contact, and that's one of the key things that they wanted to see. He had a high strikeout rate, and they wanted to get the strikeouts down, have him make contact. That has been going well so far. So Blaine Beatty is showing some things. And same thing for Mark Vientos, making contact. They're getting more comfortable with the team and the major leagues and relaxing and showing what they can do. Alvarez struggled for a while, but he's got 24 homers, I think it is. So he is also proving that he should be here on an everyday basis. So got a great show for you this week. I've got an interview with the co-author of two terrific books. And they are, you can't see them here, Ed Cranepool's book, The Last Miracle, and Cleon Jones's book, Coming Home. And both books are available on Amazon and fine bookstores by you. And Gary Kaschick is the co-author. And we're going to take a break and come back with him right after this.
Baseball and BBQ, your place for interesting baseball talk, opinions, and history.
Baseball and BBQ, your place for barbecue recipes, tips, and interviews from the world of barbecue. If you like baseball and if you like barbecue, then tune in to Baseball and BBQ. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and BaseballTalkRadio.com.
Did you know that Baseball PhD can be heard on BaseballTalkRadio.com?
Our shows rotate with other top baseball podcasts.
Now don't forget, that's BaseballTalkRadio.com.
With us, we'll help you get a PhD in life through baseball.
With BaseballTalkRadio.com, you'll hear the rest of the excellent universe of baseball podcasts.
Hello, baseball fans. You're listening to Baseball Talk Radio, the home of great baseball talk shows. At BaseballTalkRadio.com, you're going to find great shows like this one with the great Gary Mack and the Mets Musings podcast. And now back to the show.
Joining me this week on Mets Musing is the author of Not One, but two terrific books that are on the market right now, and they're from our 69 heroes, if you were around to remember them, as well as 73, I might add. He is author Gary Kaschick, and he joins me. Gary, welcome to Mets Musings, and two terrific books here to talk about.
Great to be on with you, Gary, and thank you for the compliments. I appreciate hearing that.
You know, I heard you on another show and you talked about that this project, really the Cleon Jones project, started with that you were interested in writing a book about the 73 Mets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so no, the Cleon book had been completed, and then but then I was on the phone with the publisher, and it was, this was 1972. So we had a full year to put together a book on the 73 Mets 50th anniversary. Perfect timing.
Right. Right.
They said if I could find four Mets who'd be interested to talk about that year, then they would do it. And I could not find four Mets. I didn't have direct contact with only with Cleon and Ed Cranepool. Ed had reached out to a few of the guys. The consensus was, who wants to read a book about a team that lost the World Series? But I so disagreed with that.
I
you know, it was one of the most interesting seasons you may never see again.
Right.
You know, the team dead last and, you know, dead in the water and not a chance in the world. And here they come on and not only win the division, beat the Reds, and they should have beat the A's. You know, should have, would have, could have, think back on all that. But I think it would have been a phenomenal book, and I'm still a little bit bummed that we didn't do it.
Right.
But that spun off into the publisher saying, well, wait a minute, Ed Cranepool doesn't have a book, which really, really surprised me. So I called Ed, and before we know it, we said, all right, let's do a book. And he had attempted it one other time with another author and didn't get off the ground for some reason. And there I was in the lucky place again. So that's how that all began.
And I've had the pleasure to talk to him a couple of times at other book signings that he showed up at, or, and I actually got to meet him once in his house when he was selling some of the memorabilia to raise some money for his medical expenses. And he said he didn't want to write a book necessarily because of he probably was joking, but he said some of the stories he had to tell or he wanted to tell, he didn't want to tell to piss off other players. So very interesting. So I was very excited when I saw that the book came out because he's just got he's a wealth of information.
Yes, he is. And apparently it must have been the right timing because, you know, he does get into a few people into the book you know, not too kind, but, you know, it's the way his perspective, his truth,
mm-hmm.
All very believable to me, every bit of it that he had to say about people. Not afraid to take a shot at somebody.
Right.
And, you know, like, you talk about 1965 when he made the All-Star team and Gene Mauch didn't play him in the All-Star game. Well, Ed kept that in him for 14 years when Mauch became the manager for the Twins and asked Ed to come out to be his DH. And he said to him, I'm not coming out here. He didn't play me in the All-Star game 14 years ago. So, you know, he has a memory, a terrific memory for all these things. And it's stories like that, I think, that are really captivating parts of the book.
Mm-hmm. And both books are very fascinating. Cleon Jones with his upbringing and, you know, through his career and even what he's doing now with Africa Town and working hard there to improve the lives of the poor in his hometown area. And Ed Cranepool with his upbringing as well as a with a single parent and his career. And, you know, you felt kind of bad for Ed Cranepool in the beginning, I shouldn't say the beginning, but he was so highly touted. And when you think about it now at 17, you know, to be that touted and he was going to be the savior of the franchise and it didn't pan out. He had a terrific career with the Mets, but it just, he wasn't Mickey Mantle, and that's what they had compared him to at a young age.
Well, they did that with Bobby Mercer too, and they,
yeah,
they, mm-hmm. they just wanted Ed to, you know, be that guy. And it's an awful lot of pressure put on someone, especially going to a team that is going to be losing 100 games a year, mixed in with all these old veterans, many who made it to the Hall of Fame. You know, it went onto his shoulders and he took it very seriously. He did not like losing at all. No one does, but he didn't want to be part of history on a 120 loss team. He didn't want to be any of that. And, you know, so by the time 1969 rolls around, he's ready and, he's ready to go on this roller coaster ride of down, up, and then back down. So, you know, he did have a great career. He never really was given a chance to be the starter. I don't think. Always seem to be some other first baseman in the mix that, you know, with this platoon system that they liked. And it's incredible when you really think about it. And as I learned more about him, that he lasted as long as he did for one team.
Yeah. Yeah. And may have stayed longer. With the turnover of the owners and everything, that kind of, I don't want to say chased him out, but him to leave.
He didn't see the point anymore. He didn't want to go to another team in another city. He felt like he was starting at the bottom again with those Mets teams that, you know, were losing more than winning. And he just didn't have it in him to hang around as a pinch hitter for a team that had no chance of, you know, reaching the promised land.
Mm-hmm. And I think people forget, too, that he was a pretty good fielding first baseman. I mean, if given the opportunity. But, you know, as we all know, Don Clendenin came in June of 69 when they wanted to get that. As you say, they wanted to get that platoon. They liked that platoon. And Art Shiemski had played some first base as well. And he was relegated to the outfield, but platooning with Swoboda. And I know they both had their differences with Gil Hodges, though that argument was blown up a little bit, I think. Between Gil Hodges and Crane Poole and Art Shiemski.
Well, no, it was Crane Poole, Swoboda, I know what you meant to say that. So I don't know if it was blown up because Ed told the story very succinctly to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the right thing to be doing to Gil Hodges. He didn't want to get on his wrong side.
Right.
And flipping back to what you said earlier in your statement with Ed being a terrific first baseman, you know, he had a year or two there where his fielding percentage was better than Wes Parker, who was a perennial Gold Glover. Parker had a lot more chances, of course, a little more flashy. Ed was just a steady Eddie, they called him, and that's one of the reasons. He didn't have great range, but he always caught with two hands. So he didn't have a flashy glove at first base, but he made the plays, and his fielding percentage is terrific. And there was one year where he could have been a Gold Glover, but Parker had more chances. The thing with Hodges, that happened, and that took a couple of years before things settled down and Ed got his chance again.
And of course, going to talk about Cleon Jones a little bit, he had the big year in 69 with the 340 batting average and just was terrific. And a little controversy too, though, with Gil Hodges with the when he took him out of the game walking out to left field, which was odd. And you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, talking to the other players, so Cleon, there was so much water. It was they were getting killed by Houston. It ended up 16-3. Johnny Edwards hit an opposite field double. They just kind of dropped in there and didn't roll at all. It just laid in the water. And Cleon was nursing a bad ankle. And, you're not going to go running hard for a ball in the water and slip and then be out for the rest of the year. So, and there was no chance to get him at second base, but it didn't look good. So when Gil came out, I know that Nolan Ryan wondered why he was coming out because he had just brought him into pitch. And then he walked by Buddy Harrelson. Harrelson wondered, like, what's he got? What's he taking me out for? Then Harrelson, he got out to left field, and they thought, where's he going, into the bullpen? And he stopped with Cleon. So it is a very unusual thing. I don't know if I've ever seen that before. But Gil was walking like Mickey Rivers. You know, walking out of his house, going as slow as somebody could, and but Cleon said that he didn't take him out because of the lack of effort. Mm-hmm. However, the perception was that he did, and the other players responded by thinking, "Holy cow, he can take out Cleon Jones, who's leading the league in hitting. He could take anything." So it was really Gil Hodges using his influence and his smartness to you know, gather the forces on a doubleheader. They were got bombarded by Houston. So it was a good move and a little controversial, but that's the truth from Cleon.
Right. And as you say, that Shea Stadium in those days, boy, that field held the water, as we all know, if you were around at that time. And it was terrible until they dug it up later in the 80s and redid the drainage there. But it was an awful mess. So you could see why he did that. But, you know, he finished the year, had a great year, of course, the playoffs and the World Series, and the rest is history. But as you say, 73 was a fascinating year for the Mets, and only because they played so bad and yet were a pretty decent team and were able to pull it out at the end.
Well, you know, the big game there, of course, is the ball off the wall game. Against Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a ball hit the top of the fence and come back in with the way that ball did. And Pittsburgh was 2.5 games up. They're going to win that game if that ball goes over the fence. It would have been 3.5 games up with just maybe, I think, 5 or 6 to play. The chances were really next to nothing that the Mets would win that. But the ball popped off the wall. Cleon Jones fielded it through to, I believe it was Wayne Garrett or Kenny Boswell, one of those two guys, and threw it home, and they got the guy at the plate, and then they won in the next inning to cut the lead to 1.5, one game in the loss column. So you talk about a game of inches. You know, it really is. And that was part of a miracle to me of that 73 team. When you talk about the 69 miracle Mets, then, I mean, what's more miraculous than a ball coming back the other way? And then the plays being made to get the guy at home plate. It was incredible.
They were just short that last miracle in the World Series. And, of course, Ed Kranepel to this day swears that they should have pitched George Stone in Game 6. And yes. Yogi was wrong. And I have to agree with them there. But, you know, he thought he wanted to go with his best guy. At the time, and it didn't work out for him.
Well, this is where Ed said that if Gil Hodges had been the manager, he wouldn't have listened to any of the chatter, what any of the sports writers telling him what to do. He would have absolutely pitched George Stone. George Stone was 12-3 and had the best September down the stretch for any Met pitcher. You know, he was by far their top pitcher in that last month, so he was hot. You know, Seaver lost the game, so they still had a chance in Game 7, but it deflated the team, apparently, enough where they just lost that game, and it's too bad because that would have been an incredible ending to a year.
Right, right. And they would have had Seaver on full rest in Game 7 instead of Matlack going and Seaver going at 6 on short rest. So, you know, that's history, and I always say if you want to know about your team, you should look at the history of the team and study the history. Too many people don't study the history, and that's why I think it's great when books like this come out, because it is guys that we've heard about that are icons and legends, and, you know, then you can learn about them. You can learn the human side, and you really get to that. And how do you find it? So it seems I'm always amazed when I talk to an author and they write a book like this. And it's just it just seems like you're sitting in the living room with the guy talking baseball. And that's a style that is hard to come by. And you do it beautifully in these two books.
Thank you so much. And that's my goal. You know, you want to find the voice of the person that you're writing this book about. And after a while, you interview and you record and then you transcribe. You are hearing that voice and you write mostly what they said and some of the things I put in as a writer. So that to hear it from you is a big compliment. I thank you for that. And I try to do the same with Ed. It's funny. Someone had said to me recently, well, it wasn't Shakespeare with Ed's book. It was, you know, not very flowery. And my response was, well, he doesn't use a lot of adjectives. I wasn't going to use my vocabulary in place of Ed's vocabulary. I'm like, just like you said, you're sitting down and listening to him. And I don't know, maybe it just comes naturally to me, but thank you again. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
Is it a difficult process to draw out some of these stories, or do you go in looking for certain things, or do you just let them talk and then try to draw other things out of them that may have interested you or that you read about or heard about in the past?
Right. So it's a little bit of both. So, you know, you're both Cleon and Ed were really easy to talk with. So they made it easy for me to then listen to what they're saying and then come up with some new questions based on that and then go off on that. Of course, you're studying everything about their career, anything that's written. You know, you're using Baseball Reference, you're checking everything out, you're looking at some old clippings, maybe talking to some of their old teammates. But in the end, you need to put some stories in that people don't know about. It's important. They don't want to just read the same old stuff they knew about before. So that's what I told both Cleon and Ed, is that we got to find something that's different, something unique and different, and even if it's something unusual. And then I'll throw out some, you know, maybe it was a bus road. Maybe you were staying at a hotel and somebody, came in late. It is something that might trigger them. And it helped. And, you know, you end up doing about 20 to 25 hour interviews with each guy. It's a lot. And, but they made it easy on me. I recently was doing another book with someone that didn't work out, and he had just no information, nothing at all to give me. And so you need, I know you've listened to Ed recently. It doesn't take much for a question for him to talk. And he's on point. So answer your question. Yeah, it's a little bit of both. And then you go year by year. You look at what happened in the country, what happened in the world. Maybe that'll trigger their memory for something. Maybe they were somewhere when something happened, like when the lights went out in New York, for example. Or when the assassinations or Woodstock, something that triggers memories in all of us. And that's what I am hoping for. And both of those guys provided that great, really great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because when you really look back and you think of the events over the both of their careers, really that happened, you mentioned some, the assassinations, the moon landing, Woodstock. I mean, and that was all in 69. I mean, you know, you had the moon landing, Woodstock, the Mets winning. I mean, it was really, and then onwards, the Nixon resignation. I mean, it's just an incredible tie-in with history. And you do tie that in, which is wonderful for people to read.
Thank you. Yeah, and there was a lot of history being made. It was a transition period for our country. You know, not only the Mets, you had the Knicks and the Jets, all within it. So, you know, living in New York as a sports fan at the time was just was incredible. You know, I was living in Binghamton, New York, and you know, we rooted for all those teams just like we were, as if we were in New York City. Those are the we got WOR and WPIX, and we listened to Marv Albert, and we did all that. So probably the best year for any sports city was that time right there.
Yeah, 1969, it certainly was. Baltimore's had, I think, a similar thing. Pittsburgh definitely had with the Steelers and the Penguins. And it's happened other places, but it was a special time in sports history, and it's all captured very succinctly and interestingly. And I find it also, your style is very easy to read. It's not, you know, sometimes you can get bogged down in, but both of these books are similar in that they just flow.
Thank you for that. And so my style is one thing. My attack going forward in any other book I might do is the same. I'm going to start at the beginning I'm not going to jump around and go 10 years ahead and then 6 years back and then 4 years ahead. It's going to go in the order that that person lived it. And not every book is done that way. I'm comfortable doing that way. And the comments you just made are what others are making. So apparently it's working.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you've also written some fictional books. Is there anything that you prefer? Do you prefer one over the other, nonfiction over fiction, or equally as interesting?
Well, fiction is probably easier because you can just make things up as you go. You can just make things up. It's interesting, though, the dialogue, which is a key part of any book, is my favorite thing to do in the fiction. And you have to remember to, your characters are all different. They all have a different background. They all have a different vocabulary and level of education. You have to become each one of those characters and remember that this person had an eighth grade education and this person was a fluent speaker. Right. So it's fun to do that way. But I had one, my fiction book was a historical fiction based on tons of facts. I had so much fun doing that. There was 500 pages. But this I find to be more fun because never in my wildest dreams would I be thinking as I fast forward my life from watching Cleon Jones and Ed Cranepool and all these other guys now that I am friends with, that I would be writing their books and being on shows like yours talking about it. So this is really what I want to do going forward. I have some ideas for some fiction books. I was dabbling with the Field of Dreams 2, working on that a little bit. But this is really what it's the whole experience of doing it is. I love the process, from start to finish. So
right,
I think I like it a little bit more than the fiction.
Okay, and any other works coming up? What are you working on right now?
Working on something for several years, and it's finding it very difficult. Dummy Hoy was a deaf ball player in the 19th century. A lot of people might not know that name. William Dummy Hoy. Mm-hmm. They called him Dummy, and he embraced that name. He's very smart. Someone who at one time I thought should be in the Hall of Fame, not so much anymore, but been working on that book. Very difficult because the sports writers didn't want to talk to him after a game. He couldn't really communicate with them. So right. Most of my information I'm getting are from the deaf magazines and deaf people. So that's got a ways to go. I've been really slowly going on that. I keep my doors open. A few years ago, Bucky Dent almost worked out, the old Yankee. And look, if anybody has any suggestions, they want to see a book written on someone. That's all it is. You get a name, maybe they don't have a book, maybe they want to do a book, and then before you know it, you got one together. So
it might be an interesting book. Ed Hearns, the backup catcher for the 86 Mets. I don't think he's written anything, and he's really had some incredible life, both bad and good. But he might be something to consider.
It's just into a different era. It gets us out of
right.
Season 70s. And I will keep that in mind, and maybe I'll talk to you later about that. I'd like to do Jerry Grody. There is now.
Yeah. One. Yeah.
That's probably the next guy I'll be reaching out to. Not that I want to keep doing books on the Mets, but Grody, I think, will be an interesting story. Is
right.
Such a lion of that team. Is such a hard-nosed, stubborn guy. We'll see where it all goes.
We'll see what happens. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today, and these are two terrific books. It's Cleon Jones Coming Home, My Amazing Life with the New York Mets, and Ed Cranepool, The Last Miracle. And of course, The Last Miracle getting a kidney donated to him and life-saving, and he looks fantastic and he's doing well, and both books are terrific. And I want to thank you, Gary, for coming on today.
I appreciate taking the time with me and being as generous as you were. Thank you, Gary.
And we'll be right back after this. And now it's time to go down on the farm, and let's take a look at the standings to start off. Syracuse is 21-36. They are 14.5 games back. Next to last place in their division, Binghamton is 34-25. They are but a half game back in second place of their division. Brooklyn is tied for first in their division. They hold a 36-27 record. And these are all second half records. St. Lucie, don't think they're going to be making the playoffs. St. Lucie is 19-42. They are 13 games back and in last place in their division. The Mets' number one ranked prospect now is Luis Angel Acuna. He went 3-for-5 with 2 home runs the other night, and it was his first homers, that is, as a member of the Rumble Ponies. He also had a stolen base, so he's starting to feel his way, get comfortable being in a different organization now. Bats starting to warm up. Kevin Parada went 2-for-5 with a home run, while Jeremiah Jackson had a homer of his own as he went 2-for-4 with a walk. Drew Gilbert went hitless but had 2 walks and a run, and this is again the other night with Binghamton. Parada was promoted, struggled a little bit. He's starting to find his way now. Bats starting to get hot. Down in Brooklyn, Jet Williams just doing a great job. The Mets' number 3 prospect. The other night, 2 nights ago, he went 2-for-4 with a triple and a walk and an RBI and a run. He's hitting over 300 the last I looked, and is getting comfortable in the minors and finding his way. He's 19 years old, folks. So he's been playing a lot of shortstop and center field a little bit. So they're making him more versatile. And, you know, there's bright spots down there. And these trades, I know they hurt this season, but they've really helped this farm system, and we're starting to see some of the fruits of the trades. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to that point where we'll start putting players in when they get hurt. And when other players get hurt, we'll be able to move a guy in like a lot of these other teams, like Atlanta does. You know, they lose a guy in free agency, they bring another guy in. Of course, pitching now is something that's got to be worked on. But there are some good young pitchers in the system as well. And I would imagine that the draft, next year's draft, the Mets will go heavy on the pitching. Can't say for sure, but I think they feel now that they have a couple of prospects in the system that can hit. And that goes as far as the team, with a Mauricio and with a Beatty and a Vientos and Alvarez. And I think as we go forward with Acuna and Drew Gilbert and the other gentleman that they got with, I can't think of his name right now, but with a Jet Williams and a Parada and these guys, you know, I think they feel confident that they'll have enough bats, and what they'll probably do is go heavy. It's a long way off the draft, so it's hard to predict, but you know, perhaps they'll go for the pitching and go for college pitchers. We'll have to see how that all shakes out next year when it comes about, but anyway, I think that'll wrap it up for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Gary Kaschek. I had a blast doing it. He's a terrific guy. And go check out the books, Ed Cranepool's The Last Miracle and Cleon Jones Coming Home. 2 terrific books, and he's really got a great style of writing. Makes you feel like you're right there, talking to the player, and A lot of it is the player. Of course, it's his stories, it's his life, but a lot of it is the way that it's taken by Gary Kaschuk and put down on paper. So go check them out. Two terrific books. You know, we're getting near the holiday season. Believe it or not, we're in September. It won't be long before the Christmas displays come out. So these will make great gifts for Met fans. So, again, go to your local bookstore or online, Amazon. Check it out. Pick up these copies of these terrific books. All right, and that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you all for watching or listening. If you are watching on YouTube, please hit the like and subscribe button and do the same on wherever you get your Apple Podcasts or Google Play or wherever you get your podcast, your audio podcast from. Hit the subscribe button. This way you'll always know when another edition of Mets Musings is coming out. So, until the next time, remember to keep the faith, stay optimistic, and let's go Mets, and I'll see you in the next time on another edition of Mets Musings.